Now, a con game from Africa and its historical roots in the American Midwest. A few days ago, our email account at All Things Considered had more than half a dozen letters that all said essentially the same thing. There's a lot of money out there that is rightfully mine, but I need help to get at it. If you help me now, there'll be a big payoff for you down the line. We get so many of these messages, typically from Africa, that this is what our email would sound like on some days.
I am Mr. Edward Mpoyo, a member of the Movement for Democratic Change in Zimbabwe.
We are members of the Special Committee for
Budget and Planning. I am Mr. Ahmed Garuba, the Bills and Exchange Director at the Foreign Remittance Department.
I am David Mapele, the first son of Dr. Jonathan Mapele.
I am Mrs. Nkrumah.
I am Mr. Samson Imana Ajay, a former...
I am Edward William, the only son of 40 Williams.
I am a member of the Federal Government of Nigeria, National Petroleum Corporation.
I am so troubled. My spirit refuses to be at rest. The quick need for contacting you is because my husband has been killed unjustly, and I am sure if we don't act fast, head of the Emirates must come for our wealth, and millions of American dollars will be seized. About 83 million U.S. dollars my husband has in his private vault has been successfully deposited.
What we need from you, sir, is to provide a very vital account in which the funds will be transferred.
For this reason, kindly furnish us your contact information, that is, your personal telephone and fax.
However, we will sign a binding agreement to bind us
together. You will give us our own fair share of 70% without running away with the money or sitting on it.
The finance company is standing by to receive my instructions on this, and I will link you up with them as soon as you're ready to take possession of the $32 million. Finally, you are to note that in your reply, you are to state your residential or company address, and if possible, send a copy of your international passport so as to assure me that my money is safe in your hands.
Send your money to one of these heart-rending, down-and-out, but just for the moment, supplicants, and you can count on never seeing it again. This is a confidence game so well-worn it has a name. The emails are called Nigerian Letter Schemes, or Nigerian 419 letters. That's the number of the Nigerian statute that bans this variety of fraud. John Kane collects information about these rackets at the Internet Fraud Complaint Center in Fairmont, West Virginia.
The U.S. Secret Service estimates that in the last several years, just in the United States alone, there have been confirmed losses of at least $100 million. Since the mid-90s, it's estimated that $5 billion worldwide have been lost to this particular scam.
These are called Nigerian letter schemes, but I gather not all of them are from Nigeria.
That's correct. The fraud originated in Nigeria. However, individuals all over the world do participate. There are other African countries where this is an industry. Additionally, some of these criminals have been linked to the United Kingdom and Canada, for example. However, most of the fraud does appear in Nigeria, and even those individuals outside the country tend to say they are from Nigeria or similar parts of Africa.
Often we hear that someone famous is mentioned in these. The person writing the letter is the son of some figure prominent in Africa, or the wife of, or the widow of, whatever it might be. Typical?
That's typical. Usually the person writing to you will be a high-ranking government official, an industry or banking executive, or the family member of a very prominent figure who has recently been deceased and has a large sum of money that they need your help in getting out of the country.
And typically, is it actually that person who's writing?
Actually, it's usually a collective of individuals. Many of these groups are highly organized. You'll have one individual who may facilitate the writing of the letters, one individual who may doctor up the paperwork to make it look like it is a legitimate government entity. However, most of the time, if those individuals are real, the names of real people, those aren't the people that are writing the letters. It's simply other individuals who are borrowing their names or making up fictitious names and assigning them titles to make it sound like these are very prestigious individuals within the country.
September 11th spawned some new variations on this theme, I gather.
That's correct.
What sort of cons are those?
Well, three of the variants that we've seen. One is a plea from an Afghan merchant who, because of the war on terrorism and the political uprising over there, would like to start anew in the United States. And he needs your help in getting basically his money out of the country into the States so he can start this brand new life. The second variant is an individual who is tasked with depositing a large amount of money on the day that the World Trade Center has collapsed. Him and the money are assumed to be missing, so he has all this money and he needs, once again, your help in basically laundering this money so he could keep it and do whatever he needs to do with it. And then the third variant is actually, I'm a member of a United States commando force who were over in Afghanistan, and they see some al-Qaeda money, $35 million, for example. And once again, they'd like you to hold the money until their tour of duty is over, and then they can come back and they will give you 10, 15, 20% for your participation. And usually you're going to need to pay some type of fees to facilitate the shipping of this money back to the States.
John Kane of the Internet Complaint Center. All these email scams from Nigeria or Congo, or now from Afghanistan, are descendants of an older scam that thrived in the American Midwest during the early years of the 20th century. It was based on a premise that was as fraudulent as it was seductive. This was the idea. Sir Francis Drake, the 16th century English navigator and privateer, gained fabulous wealth from his explorations. But when he died, his will was defective, and Queen Elizabeth I hijacked his estate, disinheriting Drake's rightful heirs, some of whom migrated to America. In mass meetings, Americans, some of whom believed that they were Drake descendants, were told that they could have a piece of the vast Drake estate if only they would invest in the effort to sue for it in London. Author Richard Rayner has written a book about this Drake estate scam and about the man who operated it in the 1920s, a failed farmer from Sioux City, Iowa, named Oscar Hartzell. Hartzell started out a victim of the con game and ended up running it, playing on themes that resonated with Americans of the day.
When Drake's descendants, some of them, emigrated to America in the 18th century, this legend of money that might have been available to people that was somehow tied up back in Britain began to gather momentum. So what the scamsters did was to take what little historical evidence there was, bind it together with the idea that some Midwesterners had that, well, we came from there. Mm-hmm. Isn't there a piece of us that's been left back there, and can we get our hands on it?
Well, describe how Oscar Hartzell, who's the character your book is really about, how he could convince people that there was some reason to part with some money, to give it to him in the hopes of achieving a lot more money from the estate of Sir Francis Drake.
Well, the psychology of Hartzell is a fascinating thing in this story, and the thing that intrigued me the most, and his attitude towards the scheme itself changes over time. So when he first becomes involved in it in about 1914, he was a believer. After a few years of working for these two shysters with the wonderful Dashiell Hammett-like names, Milo Lewis and Sudie Whitaker, he realized that they were frauds. So the first interesting moment for him is when, rather than blowing the whistle on these guys, he then decides, I'm going to take the scheme over. And he knows the psychological noises he should be making because he'd responded to those noises himself.
What are those noises? What is it that makes people part with money at this moment?
We promise you can get rich quick. And I believe in this. It's going to take a lot of hard work. We have to have faith. I'm employing the best possible people. I'm working day and night. I'm connected with very important people in England who are helping me get to the bottom of this, and we will get this money, or I will die in the attempt.
Well, one of the ideas he played with that I guess was persuasive to a lot of people in the Middle West, and which is quite a work of art in this realm of confidence games, was the idea that England owed so much to Sir Francis Drake, and that Queen Elizabeth had gotten more than her fair share of his riches, that when the estate was finally settled in favor of the rightful heirs somewhere in the Midwest of the U.S., England would be bankrupt, and therefore the British authorities were doing everything they could to obstruct Oscar Hartzell.
It was a genius idea, and one of my favorite moments in the story is that shortly after the Depression hits, John Maynard Keynes, the world's leading economist, writes an article in the Saturday Evening Post, it's in 31, saying that the way out of the depression is to spend money. He talks about Britain's foreign investment fortune and mentions how this foreign investment fortune was essentially founded on the money that Queen Elizabeth took from Drake's privateering expeditions. So this is in the Saturday Evening Post, and how that Britain would have been, would never have become a major power without this money, which is exactly what Hartzell had been telling his folks back in Iowa and Nebraska all along, that it's all about the money that Elizabeth took from Drake. It's been gathering compound interest all this time. The British are terrified of giving it back to us, because when they do, their entire economy is going to collapse.
How much money do you think Hartzell got out of people who thought they were investing in the Drake estate?
They reckoned that in the terms back then, it was $1.5 million, which would be about $15 million bucks today.
And with it, he managed to live quite a handsome lifestyle in London.
Oh, he did. He rented himself an apartment in Knightsbridge in a very handsome mansion block, which I went and looked at. He was having his suits made at Savile Row. He had his own personal table, number 101, at the Savoy. And really, he would have prevented himself being busted if he had made the appearance in London of going through the legal motions of trying to get hold of the Drake estate, even though it was impossible to get hold of the Drake estate. Mm-hmm. If he'd gone through those motions, he would have gotten away with it.
When we hear about new confidence games coming out of Nigeria with a very similar pattern to what happened with the estate of Sir Francis Drake, is that because you just can't keep a good idea down? Or is it because there's actually some folklore that con artists pass down from generation to generation over drinks in seedy bars?
Well, I do think that the scam, the con, operates like a fairy tale, which is to say that it operates with well-repeated, well-tested, well-tried formulas. The Nigeria scam is exactly the Drake estate in modern dress. It just seems plausible enough. There always has to be that little nugget of plausibility that is in some way attached to reality, and that becomes the springboard for the fantasy that the con man can sell and in which it's easy for us to believe.
Well, Richard Rayner, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thanks a lot.
Richard Rayner, the author of Drake's Fortune, The Fabulous True Story of the World's Greatest Confidence Artist.